from deep inside your radio.
Wow. Just getting over the fabulous, just absolutely spectacular 25th anniversary party for this program thrown by our home station. Just, I can't thank you guys enough. What a spread, what a treat, what a dream, literally. And on another note, thank you to the folks who came to the Christmas sing-along that Ms. Judith Owen and I perpetrated in Los Angeles and Seattle this past week. You were wonderful. And word to the folks in Chicago. Now, take it from the people in L.A. and Seattle. You've never seen one of these before, but it's fun. And on the other hand, you know, it wasn't 4 degrees in L.A. or Seattle. So, you know, maybe you want to wear a sweater when you come. It's this Thursday in Evanston. And let's see, and a week from today, December 14th, if you happen to be in the New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, tri-state area, the host of this broadcast will be opening a video art exhibition at the Aldrich Museum of Contemporary Art in Ridgefield, Connecticut. And I'll actually be speaking there on December 14th. The exhibition goes on for a month and a half. You know, it's my second trip into the museum world, which I love so much. I'm a museum kind of guy. Speaking of which, ladies and gentlemen, enough about me. Dateline Orlando, Florida, the U.S. Army will be occupying soon virtual territory in a bid to win recruits. Quote, over the next 30 to 45 days, you might, if you're one of them Second Life avatar dudes that likes to go populate islands within Second Life, you will find an army island in Second Life, unquote, General William Wallace, the commander of U.S. Army Training and Doctrine. The Army Second Life effort, you know, it's this virtual thing that the very exciting among us do. The Army Second Life effort will actually consist of two virtual islands. One of them will serve as a welcome center with an information kiosk and the means to contact a recruiter. The other will offer virtual experiences like jumping out of airplanes, rappelling off of towers, and using a weapon to see if we can get some kind of recruiting benefit out of this social networking. The Army will even offer virtual tchotchkes to woo recruits. If you perform well in the activities, you get points, and those points can be used to buy virtual T-shirts and baseball caps. Well, you can wash them in your virtual laundry. Dry them in your virtual dryer. Have a whole life. Wallace says he's a realist when it comes to social networking technologies. He admits they've probably been oversold, but he won't write them off either. The recruiting possibilities are just too alluring. He says there's about 4 million young people that routinely interface in Second Life. That's the age group of the young people we're trying to grind up in the military. Oh, and we're trying to encourage to join the military. Mm. Good luck with the whole Second Life dudes thing, sir. On the other end of the military spectrum, these stories come to mind. A missile shield test was a smashing success, Pentagon officials said Friday, living in their own virtual world. Despite the failure of the test to put to rest concerns that the interceptor might not be able to differentiate between, real missiles and decoys. 8 of the 13 missile defense tests so far have been deemed a success by the Pentagon success deemers. One key aspect of this week's test to see whether the system could tell the difference between a missile and a decoy aimed at confounding it failed because the decoy didn't deploy. Oh, it's the decoy's fault. See? It's not the system. It's the decoy. Officials had told CNN that Friday's test would be the most realistic of the 13 conducted so far. This was the first at which a crew at an alternate fire control center in Alaska. Hey, Alaska! That's good for all of us. Remotely launched the interceptor missile from California. Critics have long complained the tests are not realistic because they don't involve balloons or other simple decoys that can easily fool the intercepting missile. And apparently didn't this time either. It's the damn decoys. That won't happen in a real attack because the decoys will work. And I'll save that for later. It's too depressing. But, ladies and gentlemen, the digital wonderland beckons. Even if you don't need new equipment, the switch to digital TV may change what you watch. Some stations are adding new channels, like 24-hour weather channels. That's cheap. I mean, good. It's a brand new day for local TV, says Art Brooks of the Arizona Broadcasters Association. I think it's a great opportunity. One channel in the Houston area offers five sub-channels providing religious programming geared toward young people, children, and Spanish speakers. Paul Crouch Jr., vice president of Channel 21, says the Trinity Broadcasting Network, the Christian network that programs the station, is not planning on broadcasting in high definition. Quite frankly, he says, a singing or preaching head looks no different in standard def versus high def. When those people are telling you the truth about high def, ladies and gentlemen, you know it's near Christmas time. And your video recording apparatuses may not work completely as normal come the digital wonderland arrival date of mid-February. Old VCRs should be able to tape a program off the digital converter box, but only the show you're currently watching. You'll no longer be able to tape one show while watching another, because the VCR will have to be connected to the TV differently than it was before. Even some TiVo digital video recorders may not work with the new converter box. So, just in time, the digital conversion says, buy more stuff. You're ready for that, aren't you? Hello, welcome to the show.
Kick it down the street. That's the way to treat a friend. Right before me, the signs implore me to help the needy and show them the way. Human kindness is overflowing, and I think it's going to rain today.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, the apologies of the week. Think of it.
We're so sorry.
Don't have to think of it. It's going to actually happen. I thought of it. Something's going on at the BBC. I don't know. Something's in the water over there. Now, we have got this after that kerfuffle last month over the obscene phone calls by a couple of comedians. The British Broadcasting Corporation apologized this week after Doctor Who veteran actor John Barrowman exposed himself on a live radio show that was recorded on a webcam. Barrowman plays the charming Captain Jack Harkness, a time-traveling alien-hunting hero on Torchwood, BBC America's Doctor Who spinoff. The apology came 10 days after the BBC's management insisted it had learned its lesson on lewd contact following... Who was lewd? Did anybody get lewd? It didn't say he lewd anybody. Following a scandal in which a show's host invited his guest to reveal himself. On this most recent radio show, the host said to Barrowman, "You're famous, we're told, for getting your willy out in interviews. Is this going to happen today?" Barrowman responded by saying he was going to get it out, sparking a cacophony of shouting and laughter. Willy, you know what a willy is. Hours after pleading guilty to two felonies, Christine Beatty issued a tearful apology this week to her family, ex-Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick's family, and the citizens of Detroit for her crimes in the love affair text message scandal that caused the ousting, well, the resignation of the Detroit mayor. Sitting with her attorneys in their office, she read for a prepared three-paragraph statement, but choked up when she said why she finally agreed to a plea deal 11 months after a newspaper exposed her perjury about the affair in January. "After many months, I decided I needed to end this ordeal and not take the chance on not being there for my daughters," Beatty said, her voice thick with emotion. "I would first and foremost say that I am extremely sorry to the people who were harmed in this ordeal." She also asked that people continue to pray for her. You got it, babe. Microsoft this week apologized for... pray for Microsoft while you're at it. Microsoft this week apologized for glitches on its live search cashback site, which frustrated online shoppers hoping to scoop up Black Friday deals. Amid heavy volume, consumers encountered a range of problems from site sluggishness to seeing the wrong amount of cash back show up in their accounts. How can that happen? The problem was particularly acute with shoppers who were looking to take advantage of a promotion with Hewlett-Packard that offered a 40% discount through live search cashback. "We deeply regret customer inconvenience with respect to the outage," Microsoft said in a statement. "The spike in traffic?" Yeah, who would have expected a spike in traffic on a big bargain shopping day? "Combined with a technical glitch led to the outage. The promotion will restart. Again, we apologize. Again, we apologize. Again, we apologize for our customers' inconvenience and for the glitch in the message that said, we apologize." A Microsoft representative said the company is in the process of going back to make sure the proper cashback amount is credited. And, speaking of sorry corporations, a Moroccan subsidiary of McDonald's apologized for eliminating Western Sahara off a map that was part of its children's Happy Meal offerings. The local franchise apologized after a joint Moroccan-Sahara association protested about an error. The toys included a small map on which the borders were incorrectly drawn. "We profoundly regret making this mistake, and we apologize to our loyal customers and fellow citizens," said McDonald's Morocco. The franchise said it would replace the offending map with a Happy Meal. So you won't learn anything, but you might get sick. Dateline Boston, tell me if you've heard this before, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Springfield, has paid $4.5 million to 59 people who were sexually abused by priests. The agreements were part of a voluntary arbitration process. Some of the claims date back as far as 1948. Springfield Bishop Timothy McDonald said the diocese had a moral responsibility, never too late, babe, to reach out to those abused by clergy when they were children. He said his prayer is that the settlements are a small step toward healing, and he apologized to everyone who was hurt. The Survivors Network commended the victims for enduring years of delay. Sort of par for the course in this sort of deal, and called on the Springfield Diocese to reach out to other clergy sex abuse victims. Holding your breath yet? The superintendent of Mesa Public Schools in Arizona apologized to the father of two disabled boys. The father was angered by the district's special education director's use of a parking space reserved for the handicapped. Superintendent Deb Duval issued the apology in a letter, she said to Chris Beckham. Beckham has two sons with muscular dystrophy, said he was appalled by the, quote, absolute arrogance of special ed director William Santiago. Beckham said he merely asked Santiago not to park in the handicapped spot. But as the two argued, Beckham said Santiago told him, "Just because you have a hard life doesn't mean the world owes you everything." Illegal use of a handicapped parking space in Arizona can result in a $101 fine. Santiago was not cited. During a news conference on budget reductions, Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, Democrat, apologized for a hot mic statement he made earlier this week, saying that Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano is perfect for the position of Homeland Security Secretary because she has no family. What I meant is that Janet is a person who works 24/7, just like me, Rendell said. Homeland Security, now sponsoring NPR. It's a warm, fuzzy feeling you get when you hear that, isn't it? This will send some of our listeners' memories reeling back. Rolf Harris, famous for a hit record, Tie Me Kangaroo Down Sport. Yeah, I don't write him. But also had a career in Britain after that. He slipped out several disparaging comments against Aboriginal people last week. Yes, he's still alive. He's now apologized for any offense he may have caused. He said he regretted using references to Aboriginal people, in his hit song, Tie Me Kangaroo Down Sport. He went on to say, you sit at home watching the television and you think to yourself, get up off your arse and clean up the streets your bloody self. And why would you expect somebody to come in and clean up your garbage, which you've dumped everywhere? But then you have to think of yourself, that's a different attitude to life. The comments caused outrage among indigenous people. After the media kerfuffle, a jet-lagged and rather ill Harris came forward to make amends. I would just like to apologize for any offense that I've caused. It's all a matter of really feeling rough and having somebody jump onto me for a quote about something or other. I quite honestly should have kept my mouth shut and gritted my teeth and not said anything. I would just like to apologize for causing offense to anybody. That's his accent. I'm sorry. This week, PepsiCo got into hot water, according to Ad Age blogger Chris Abraham. After suicide-themed ads many found offensive were brought to light. One protester received an email from B. Bonin Bow of PepsiCo on Twitter regarding the ads that were run in Germany in a lifestyle magazine. Pepsi says the ads won't run again after it's received heavy criticism all over the web. I saw your tweet, says Bow. Or bow, and I just wanted to make sure I responded personally. We agree this creative, meaning the copy in the ad, is totally inappropriate. We apologize, and please know it won't run again. Thanks for the feedback. My best friend committed suicide, and this is a topic very close to my heart, so again, I offer my deepest apologies. Dallas Stars instigator Sean Avery. Instigator. He's a hockey player, is what this AP copy is trying to imply. Apologized this week for comments about his former girlfriends that led to an indefinite suspension by the National Hockey League. You got to be bad to be suspended by the Hockey League. Quote, I would like to sincerely apologize for my off-color remarks to the press from Calgary, he said. I should not have made those comments, and I recognize they were inappropriate. It was a bad attempt to build excitement for the game, but I'm now acutely aware of how hurtful my actions were. I caused unnecessary embarrassment to my peers. He embarrassed his fellow hockey players. But the statement goes on. I apologize for offending the great fans of the NHL, the commissioner, my teammates, my coaching staff, and the Dallas Stars management and ownership. As many of you know, I like to mix it up on and off the ice from time to time. But I understand this time I took it too far. He's been summoned to New York for a hearing with the commissioner of the Hockey League. What did he say? Oh, he said, I'm going to say just one thing. I'm really happy to be back in Calgary. I love Canada. I just want to comment on how it's become like a common thing in the NHL for guys to fall in love with my former girlfriends. I don't know what that's about, but enjoy the game tonight. That embarrassed hockey players, ladies and gentlemen. It's a new breed. Deadline Pomona, Cal Poly Pomona has apologized for an error that made the personal information of nearly 700 people available on the internet. The top law enforcement official of India, Home Minister Palaniappan Chidambaram. Sorry about that. You know, in the old days, Associated Press copy used to include what they called pronouncers for the announcers to pronounce. No longer. He has apologized for lapses that allowed the gunmen to rampage through Mumbai. There have been lapses. I would be less than truthful if I said there had been no lapses, he told reporters this week. He assumed his post just days ago following the ouster of the previous home minister. in the attack's aftermath. It might have seemed funny during the party, but a photo was surfaced in recent hours of President-elect Barack Obama's new chief speechwriter, Jon Favreau, groping a cardboard cutout of Hillary Clinton, the new Secretary of State designate, if she gets past the little thing with the Constitution's Emoluments Clause. Google it. Favreau, in a photo was published in the Washington Post blog, the shot of the 27-year-old writer with his hand on the 60-year-old cardboard senator's breast, appeared for about 2 hours on a Facebook page before disappearing, including one of him dancing with the cardboard female secretary designate. An Obama spokesman says Favreau has apologized to the former first lady. He said he has reached out to Senator Clinton to offer an apology. All right. Microsoft apologizes again for the bumpy rollout of the new Windows Live services that began this week and acknowledged a number of problems that need to be fixed. It's the theme. Microsoft began the rollout of the new Windows Live, which joins several services into a single, more social-style portal. The initial updates were proved to be buggy and problematic for users. It's Microsoft. What do they want? At the end of the day, Microsoft acknowledged some of the most prevalent problems and apologized to users for the growing pains. The company is now 30 years old. But an again, Pomona, maybe the apology capital of the week this week. Officials are apologizing to a Pomona woman for erecting other people's headstones above her parents' grave at the Riverside National Cemetery. Speaking of President-elect Obama, this is about a week and a half ago, but he too joined the apology parade.
I'm going to call on Steve Toma. Where's Steve? And the reason I'm going to call on Steve, I understand that as a lifelong White Sox fan, you were placed in the Cubs section yesterday. And I want to apologize for that. This is also part of the new way of doing business. When we make mistakes, we admit them.
That's the voice of this decade. Now, ladies and gentlemen, concluding our apologies of the week, the voice of the previous decade from Las Vegas, Nevada, shackled and contrite. Really? O.J. Simpson.
Yes, Your Honor, I stand before you today, sorry, somewhat confused. I feel apologetic to the people of the state of Nevada. The only person I requested to help me here was Mr. Stewart. I did request him. I needed his car. I asked him if he had some guys to help me remove these things from the room. I didn't ask anybody to do anything but to stand behind me, allow me to yell at these guys, and then help me remove those things. You know, I wasn't there to hurt anybody. I just wanted my personal things, and I realized I was stupid of me. I am sorry. I didn't mean to steal anything from anybody, and I didn't know I was doing anything illegal. I thought I was confronting friends and retrieving my property. So I'm sorry. I'm sorry for all of it.
You know, just confronting friends with guns. What would be illegal about that? I'm sorry. I'm just celebrating. It's, it's a good thing. But it does put me in mind of a very different O.J. Shortly after the trial, there was the thing, 13 years ago, 14, whatever it was. NBC, which at the time was run by a good friend of O.J. Simpson's, Don Olmeyer, had announced it was going to do an exclusive interview with him and then sort of backed away from it with in the face of a storm of outrage. And then tried again.
This is a special report from NBC News. The Simpson interview, a second chance. Now, reporting from the NBC News Bureau in Los Angeles, Tom Brokaw. Hello from Los Angeles. In the lee of last week's hullabaloo about our planned exclusive interview with O.J. Simpson, we at NBC News have spent many hours of expensive soul-searching. Excuse me, extensive soul-searching.
We realized that there was a great deal of curiosity about what O.J. Simpson would say in a no-holds-barred interview format, and that there was, as well, a great reservoir of anger about giving Mr. Simpson, as so many said, a platform. Given this collision of interest, and in the hope that we can scare CBS and Fox out of programming still another evening, NBC News has asked me to host this broadcast, a no-holds-barred interview in which I'll ask journalistically appropriate questions, and in which the answers will come from the what the court record in the Simpson murder trial contains of O.J. Simpson's own comments, mainly from the exercise videos. It's not exactly like a computer fight between two heavyweights of different generations. And it is live. Incidentally, Katie Couric is on assignment, completing a five-part series on Jason Priestley. Mr. Simpson, first, welcome to this broadcast.
Okay, you got it.
At the outset, sir, some general questions about your preparation for this interview. Sources tell NBC News you went to your former NFL home to participate in practice interviews, and that your performance in those rehearsals did not please your attorneys.
Well, in Buffalo, I was ice skating, but it was on the football field.
But you still feel ready for a no-holds-barred interview tonight?
Without hurting ourselves, huh?
Possibly. Mr. Simpson, a defense witness, Mr. Heitra, is reliably reported to have told police investigators that he heard what he thinks was an Afro-American voice arguing with a man who said, "Hey, hey," in the vicinity of 875 South Bundy.
No problem. No shame here.
Are you saying, sir, that yours is the voice he overheard? And if so, what were you saying at the time?
A little Arnold Schwarzenegger working here. Hey!
And that would indicate that you were at a murder scene at the time in question.
Yeah, look at that follow-through.
Actually, it's a follow-up. But let's turn to what life was like for you during the 15 months you were in jail. As a celebrity, what was your attitude towards the sheriff's deputies?
You had no chance trying to guard me.
Sources inside the defense camp have indicated to NBC News that you spent much of your time in jail reading Greek mythology. What did you gain from that experience?
Well, I remember the worst injury you can have is what they call an Achilles heel.
Well, it certainly wasn't good for Achilles. Mr. Simpson, let's return to the crime scene, if we can.
All right, picking up the pace.
Incidentally, does talking about this matter make you experience any nervous reactions?
There's one that's really kind of funny. It's called the buttock squeeze. I'm not going to really show it to you, but...
All right. You've been found not guilty of the crime, but many questions linger about your actual involvement.
Now, this is something I would have a little problem with.
Uh-huh. Were you at Nicole's condominium on the night of the murders?
We're just trying to get that blood flowing.
Let me make sure we're perfectly clear on this, Mr. Simpson. Is your answer yes?
That's the whole point of this, huh? Get the blood flowing.
Well, according to Kettle Kellen, the two of you went to McDonald's earlier that evening, and there's been much speculation as to why. What was your purpose in going to McDonald's?
Quickly available and long-lasting energy.
Is this a veiled reference to the allegations that you were purchasing drugs there? What were you getting at McDonald's?
Fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, potatoes, pasta, cereal, breads made from whole grain, legumes, brown rice, and bran.
Mr. Simpson, with all due respect, are you having difficulty giving factual answers to these questions?
But if you look at it, I'm beginning to sweat a little bit here, you know?
All right. Let's return to the crime scene, if we may. The defense contention is that the struggle between the victims and the perpetrator, or perpetrators, was a long one. What's your opinion of that contention?
Who went to their knees? This is fun.
Yeah, good. And at the time of the murders, considering that you seem to be implying some involvement on your part in what happened there, were you experiencing guilt about that involvement? What were you thinking?
Think how good I'm going to feel tomorrow, huh?
Uh-huh. That is to say, the next day.
It worked.
All right, let's turn, if we may, to the note you left the day of the now notorious low-speed chase. In it, you said you sometimes felt like a battered husband.
This old heart of mine been broke a thousand times. I'm still singing.
Does that belie a feeling of victimization that may be truly heartfelt?
Yeah, right from the chest, huh?
That's a peculiar place to locate that emotion, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, I don't do a whole lot of this. This is like new to me.
You're not used to speaking about your emotions?
I did a little of that on the football field in Buffalo.
All right, let's leave emotions and return to feelings. How did you feel about the crime?
Yeah, I think if you just did this every day, you'll feel so much better.
Do you seriously mean that?
Let's just try to get that blood flowing.
Mr. Simpson, does that imply a certain laxness in your commitment to significant others in your life?
Get loose and I feel like going. You know, getting loose juice, as they call it.
All right, sir, I guess we're making a little bit of news here tonight with these revelations. Let's press onward. Assuming your involvement in this gruesome struggle, what was the hardest part of it for you?
I'm a golfer, and it's that lower back that's a big problem.
Your knees were not a problem?
Oh, yeah. You got it. I feel like dancing.
The knees look fine now.
It's like the Watusi, isn't it?
I know we said no ground rules, Mr. Simpson, but I didn't realize that that would include dancing.
Oh, that's great.
In the little lot of time left to us this evening, Mr. Simpson, let's turn to the exercise video in which you said something about hitting the wife.
You just got to get your space in if you're working out with the wife, if you know what I mean. You could always blame it on working out.
Correct. Was that a veiled allusion to your own feelings of hostility towards your ex-wife? O.J. Simpson, in the brief seconds remaining, you told the New York Times this week you'd like to speak to battered women. What message do you have for them?
I want to work those buttocks. Tighten them up.
Mr. Simpson, we thank you for participating, if only by videotape, in this unique exploration of a case that we hope continues to rivet the attention of many Americans.
That's no problem. No shame here. Did it work?
Did it? Hopefully, all Americans will be the judge, and many fewer will be on the jury. I'm Tom Brokaw in Los Angeles. I'll see you tomorrow night.
This has been a special report from NBC News. The Simpson Interview, A Second Chance. NBC News was solely responsible for knowing O.J.'s friend who runs NBC. Good night.
Dear mother, I love my wife. God bless her. Even love my teenage daughter. There's no accounting for it. Apparently, I don't care how I'm treated. My love's unconditional or something. Been hurt a time or two. I ain't gonna lie. I have my doubts sometimes about the ethics of the so-called fair sex. Fair about what? But I find time goes by and one forgives as one forgets. One does forget. God bless the bottle down on memory lane. God bless the bottle. Me now, it's consigned to rhythm by my brain. I remember my father, oh, my brother, of course. Remember my mother, spoke of her earlier, and I remember that. Remember the smell of cut grass going off to play ball in the morning. Funny story about that. Now, I used to pitch. I could get the ball over the plate. Anyway, this one time, must have thrown a football around or something the day before. I walked about 14 kids in a row. Cried. Walked off the mound. Hand the ball to the third baseman and just left the field. Anyway, many years later, I brought the woman who's become my second wife, God bless her, to meet my father for the first time. Exchanged pleasantries, I left the room for a moment, It's the first time he met her, you understand? When I came back, he was telling her the story right off the bat about how I'd walked 14 kids, cried, and left them out. Next time he met her, told the same goddamn story. God bless the pothole. Down on memory lane. Memories that do remain.
This is Le Show, and now, news from outside the bubble. On the eve of the opening of the trial at Guantanamo Bay of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, you know, we've convicted Osama bin Laden's driver. Now we're getting up to the big quarry. Here comes Lieutenant Colonel Daryl Vandeveld, a former Guantanamo prosecutor who resigned over what he calls a culture of secrecy and mismanagement at the base. He tells the British newspaper The Telegraph, "It's clear that civilians running the military commissions wanted to charge the 9/11 defendants to meet an arbitrary deadline. They wanted to rush what they viewed as the worst of the worst through the system, regardless of the evidence or whether it had been obtained by waterboarding or other forms of torture." Khalil Sheikh Mohammed, of course, is one of the three that the United States admits having waterboarded. The remaining detainees include 14 high-value captives. But back to what Vandeveld says about the state of the thing. "Torture may result in reliable information, but it is torture reconcilable with our basic humanity or with America's desire to be an example to the rest of the world? The answer is no. Torture, however you define it, is wrong, appalling, immoral. As someone who saw the system from the inside, he believes the military tribunals have also been incompetently handled, something that might give pause to their supporters. He calls the handling of the first military commission trial, the driver trial, as incompetent. He calls it incompetent to the point of disbelief. The supervisory prosecutor should have been summarily relieved of command, but I suspect that none of the military services could find anyone willing to replace him. He says most military lawyers dragooned into serving at the base were unmotivated, untrained, and unsuitable. His most serious allegations are that key evidence has never been presented to prosecutors or defense counsel for the detainees. He recalls one case, "I was handed a file that supposedly contained every document, every witness statement, every lab report, but when I started to go through the disk of information, there were huge gaps. As a career prosecutor, I found that astonishing and disturbing," unquote. But wait, there's more. From Afghanistan and from the Daily Telegraph, Sunday Telegraph in London. "The nail-biting indecision of the contestants as they decide whether they need to phone a friend is familiar, but the song and dance routine in the opening credits and the host's quest to teach his audience about the martial arts are not. In a cold television studio on the outskirts of Kabul, one of the world's most successful television game shows has found a new home. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire has reached Afghanistan. Starting this week, Afghan contestants will be given the opportunity to ask the audience and confirm to their host that, yes, that really was their final answer. In one of the poorest countries in the world, more than 20,000 people have already registered to play a game which promises to make them millionaires. While a million Afghani translates to only £13,000, that's about $15,000, and it's going down. In a country where the average annual salary is estimated to be low as about $500, the jackpot is wealth beyond most people's dreams. Shams Group International, a Kabul-based company, I say again, Shams Group, has paid for the rights to the phenomenally successful show and plans to record 52-hour-long episodes. The show's host is the charismatic young Aryan Khan, an Afghan singer, dancer, model, and Taekwondo master. To highlight his talents, the producers have added a song routine at the beginning of the show where he sings about the qualities needed to become a millionaire. To cater to the country's two main ethnic groups, the show will be presented in both Pashto and Dari, and the theme song will alternate from week to week. Contestants have been chosen from all the country's provinces. The producers say one in five applicants are women. The program makers hope to avoid religious controversy. We just followed some more liberal Afghan shows where clerics have been angered by women singing or not wearing a veil. Says a producer, we don't have people singing. Whoever comes is within the framework of Islam, and we're very careful about that. The crew gained inspiration by watching different versions of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire from around the world. The British original has been their biggest inspiration. The English one is the best, says the producer. It is the purest. He's an admirer, says Khan, the Afghan presenter, of the British counterpart, Chris Tarrant. He looks wonderful as a presenter. He's dynamic. He looks good. He's very energetic. End quote. I guess they have learned. And finally, also from the Telegraph, you've noticed this probably, but you didn't realize exactly how organized it was. George W. Bush would not have ordered the invasion of Iraq if the intelligence had shown that Saddam Hussein did not possess weapons of mass destruction, according to Karl Rove, making the claim as the president's inner circle launched an unofficial Bush legacy project. The final mission on behalf of the president is being spearheaded by Rove and Karen Hughes, his former communications chief. They've been meeting senior figures in the current administration to discuss how to, quote, roll out the president's legacy, unquote. According to Stephen Hayes, a prominent conservative commentator and Vice President Dick Cheney's official biographer. That sounds like a fun job. Part of that strategy is to set the record straight, a senior Republican strategist told the Sunday Telegraph, and Rove's assertion on Iraq appears to be an opening salvo in that campaign. Rove made his comments during a wide-ranging and vigorous defense of Bush's policy record in a lively debate sponsored by Intelligence Squared U.S. in front of a packed audience. I believe they mean a packed house. Audience probably wasn't too hungry themselves. In New York, he went further, did Rove, than Bush himself, who told ABC last week, I wish the intelligence had been different, but did not take responsibility for its flaws. Bush's friends and advisors have started a loosely coordinated campaign to defend his record and promote what they see as his achievements. They think this is a good time to try to set the record straight. The president has made it clear that he's not interested in looking back or second-guessing his decisions, but his friends don't want that to mean the ground is ceded to his enemies as his presidency is debated. Rove decried what he called a peculiar form of Bush hatred that caused people to lose their rational senses about the man. Right then, rational senses. Check out Greg Thielman, who was head of the Department of State's intelligence unit devoted to anti-proliferation and nuclear stuff, who said repeatedly and publicly in the run-up to the war, that, by the way, his other job, every day he briefed John Bolton when John Bolton worked in the State Department. Thielman now says, I got the impression that Bolton didn't like any intelligence that didn't square with his pre-existing views. Thielman also said he continually reported in his work that the aluminum tubes weren't for centrifuges, that the Niger attempt to buy yellow cake didn't happen, and that the meeting with Mohammed Atta in Prague never happened, and reported that all to Colin Powell long before Colin Powell made his speech at the UN. You know, because that's just, we're losing our rational senses thanks to the Bush Legacy Project. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. We heard that. And it was good once, but this will be good now.
Oh no, oh no, by the way, be mine, be my alibi. Won't you be mine? Say, now in the streets, they're up to something, but they don't speak, they'll tell you nothing. I know the bubbling, water's a bubbling, and we best to go before they overflow.
This is Le Show, and now...
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, the IRS. You've heard of them. They're famous throughout the country. They are not well prepared in the event of serious disasters. It's not me talking. Well, it is me talking, but that's not my conclusion. It's the conclusion of the Treasury Department's Inspector General. A new report by the Inspector General for Tax Administration faulted the emergency preparedness of IRS facilities. Plans used by the IRS to respond to emergency were not always complete or subject to regular exercises or tests to ensure readiness, says the report. As in the result, in the event of an actual emergency, such as a terrorist attack or natural disaster, these deficiencies could result in delays in safeguarding employees and visitors and in beginning efforts to recover critical business processes, such as collecting tax revenue, processing refunds, and so forth. And a security breach in which two airline employees smuggled guns and marijuana aboard a commercial flight originating from Orlando a March a year ago shows gaps in the TSA's procedures. 100% screening for airline employees may not be feasible, according to a new report from the Homeland Security's Inspector General. Hey, they're sponsoring NPR. The employees of Delta Airlines took advantage of employee-only procedures to carry 14 guns and 8 pounds of marijuana across aboard the aircraft. Police, acting on a tip, removed one of the employees shortly before takeoff, but did not remove a second who remained on board with the guns and drugs. TSA has taken some action since the incident. The security breach highlights the need for additional policies and procedures to reduce vulnerabilities, the IG said. Additional policies also are needed to improve TSA's situational awareness of such incidents as they unfold. The aircraft, for example, was allowed to take off without being checked by TSA. The IG recommends the TSA have the opportunity to clear an aircraft for departure when law enforcement officers intervene before a scheduled departure. TSA says it's adopting the recommendations. Good for them. No BS from them. Now, news from the warm. News of the warm. News whatever, with whatever preposition about the warm you care to append to it, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
As the autumn cold begins to bite in the Arctic tundra, the freezing ground releases a large and unexpected burst of methane into the air. The emissions thought to be squeezed out by the growth of frost match up with an atmospheric methane surge that had previously gone unexplained. It was widely assumed methane production drops to nearly nothing over the winter because colder soil can absorb more methane and falling temperatures slow the decay process that produces the methane. Research teams that maintain automated methane monitoring stations had tended to abandon them in high northern latitudes around September, but last year, as part of a research push for the International Polar Year, a field station in Greenland stayed open for 2 months later than usual. In those months, Torben Christensen and his colleagues measured cumulative emissions as large as those recorded over the summer, with peak rates at some collection points higher than had ever before been seen in tundra. I would have predicted the exact opposite finding, says a tundra expert. See, kids, they didn't tell you about that at career day. You could be a tundra expert. If all wet meadow tundras release a similar methane burst, the authors estimate a previously unanticipated 4 million tons of the gas may be emitted each winter. The finding, reported this week in Nature, explains the strange, puzzling bump in methane. Methane bump. Keeping tropical rainforests intact is a better way to combat climate change than replacing them with biofuel plantation, a study in the journal Conservation Biology finds. The study reveals it would take at least 75 years for the carbon emissions saved through the use of biofuels to compensate for the carbon lost when the forests are whacked away. And if the original habitat was a carbon-rich peatland, restoring the carbon balance would take more than 600 years. On the other hand, planting biofuels on degraded grasslands instead of tropical rainforests would lead to a net removal of carbon in 10 years, the authors say. By discovering the meaning of a rare mineral that could be used to track ancient climates, Binghamton University geologist Tim Lowenstein is helping climatologists and others better understand what we're probably in for over the next century as global warming begins to crank up the heat. I think the Earth will be a very different place in the next 100 years or so, and that many species will adapt to it and many won't, Lowenstein said. He has been tracking an analysis of mineral samples formed during the Eocene epoch, the warmest period on Earth in the last 65 million years. What he and his colleagues have discovered is that nacolite, a rare yellowish-green or brown carbonate material, only forms on Earth under environmental conditions marked by very high CO2 levels in the atmosphere. It suggests that Eocene warming was concurrent with atmospheric CO2 levels of at least 1,100 parts per million, 3 times the current levels, but not all that much higher than we can expect on Earth in the next 100 years or so, given generally accepted scientific projections. So, major melt coming, he says, based on the nacolite. Climate change is hampering the long-term recovery of rivers from the effects of acid rain. Wet weather offsets the improvements, says a study at Cardiff University, carried out in 14 streams. The rare and timid white lemuroid possum could be the first Australian mammal to die out because of climate change. The nocturnal animal, which probably makes this sound when it's tasered, is native to the danger. I know that because of possum native to Southern California made that noise when it was tasered, when it was in our house. I didn't taste. Don't look at me. It's native to the Daintree rainforest in tropical North Queensland, where it lives off moisture in the trees. That's a nice living. Has not been sighted for 3 years, despite extensive searches. White possums normally thrive in the cooler climes of the high-altitude rainforest, but Professor Stephen Williams is concerned the animal may have become extinct due to rising temperatures. And ancient techniques pioneered by pre-Columbian Amazonian Indians are about to be pressed into service in Britain and Central America in the most serious commercial attempt yet to reverse global warming. Trials are to be started in Sussex and Belize early next year, backed with Silicon Valley venture capital, on techniques to take carbon from the atmosphere and bury it in the soil, which would act as a powerful fertilizer. The ambitious enterprise is the brainchild of two British entrepreneurs, one of the founders of Green and Black's Organic Chocolate. They aim to grow trees and plants to absorb CO2, then trap the carbon by turning the resulting biomass into biochar, a fine-grained form of charcoal that can be buried in the soil, keeping it safely locked up for thousands of years. The pre-Columbian Indians used biochar to make the poor soils of the rainforest productive for harvest after harvest. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Oh, and thanks to the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences for bestowing upon Song to the Bushman a Grammy nomination. I believe it was for Best Christmas Gift Idea of the Year. Unfortunately, in the category, I'm up against not only a brilliant guy, but a dead brilliant guy. But hey, Grammy voters, I had a death in the family this year. You know, I don't know that that means anything. But I guess if you've been waiting to see if it was, the album was any good, it's Grammy nominated, ladies and gentlemen. More can I tell you? That concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Imagine that. Around the world via the internet, on your computer, at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshear.com and kcrw.com, available as a free download to members at www.audible.com/theshow, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like you folks in Chicago coming to our Christmas sing-along in Evanston this Thursday, if you'd agree to join me next week, would you? All righty, thank you very much. A tip of the LeShow chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks, and to Pam Halstead. Playlists and mailing address, email address for this broadcast, available at the always evolving harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Bye, OJ.